So the subject was left rather open for interpretation. So I will take advantage of that. And there's a subject that I think is unique, maybe, to being in Israel in terms of Pesach Kashrus. In America, you know, by and large, we're used to a unified standard in kashrus, meaning most things, the majority of kosher products are OU certified, and what's not are probably ashkachos that are at least, you know, trying to keep similar standards to the OU. And as such, you know, most of the products that a person sees in the supermarket as kosher Pesach are going to be certified by ashkachos, by certifications that they're comfortable with. In Eretz Yisrael, you need a glossary, you know, for all the names of the ashkachos that you find in the marketplace. And some of them look very impressive. They have a lot of, as you'd say in the Mamaloshen, Yiddish Isis around, and they say all sorts of fancy things, and some of them have all sorts of fancy halachic claims about the various hidurim, the various chumros, stringencies, if you will, that they might behold. And the question is, how do we decipher what we really want to eat or not? Do we trust everything that it says on the label? Is there some sort of, you know, regulatory body? You know, in general, if you see something that says 100% juice, you assume it's 100% juice. If something says, you know, whole wheat, you assume it's whole wheat. Although that's also a tricky one. Some things are reconstituted whole wheat, meaning that they'll take white flour and they'll take bran and they'll mix it together and they'll call it whole wheat. So that's actually a little bit of a tricky thing. I don't mean to spook anybody who's, you know, a health freak or anything like that. But it's not necessarily so. In fact, there are very large Israeli bread companies that put in their whole wheat bread a little bit of coffee powder to give a slightly better coloring. But we're not going to talk about bread today because that's ostensibly not Pesach Tik. So back to the matter at hand. So, you know, Rabbi Wein has a line. He says, don't confuse the Jews with Judaism. So I'm going to say, don't confuse Yiddish Isis with Yiddishkeit, and don't confuse halachic claims to halachic observance. We'll discuss a little bit of some of the big issues with making kosher LePesach products. Okay, now I'm going to start with something which isn't so halachically oriented, more a little bit more technical. Now, it's interesting, you know, if you travel around the world and you ask people how many Jews are there in the world, they think there's billions of Jews in the world. Okay, and when you tell them, you know, no, really, there aren't, it's might be debatable depending exactly how you classify who's Jewish, right? If it's halachic Jews or if we're talking about Jews who associate themselves as Jews, etc., or various other ways people have wanted to define exactly who's Jewish. But you're talking about something, but definitely below 20 million, probably below 15 million. And, you know, they're always shocked and they'll start arguing with you about, you know, if that's the case or not. And they'll tell you, well, if there's so many Jews in so many high positions in so many places, there must be lots of regular Jews. Well, they don't realize that, no, Jews are just mutzlachim, they're successful, they end up in the right places. We have the HaKadosh Baruch Hu behind us, he puts us in the right places. And if you discuss Israel, they assume Israel is this massive, you know, piece of land. They don't realize that it's a state smaller than the size of New Jersey. It's always in the headlines. So it can't be, you know, that people are fighting over such a tiny little piece of land, especially when the Arabs have so much land. But in the actual world of marketing, they do a lot of research before they take on some sort of extra certification. So, you know, how worthwhile it is for companies around the world to be kosher certified might be debatable. But year-round, it's feasible, especially if we're doing year-round certification, which means that that they have to ensure that all their ingredients are kosher. So anything which is, you know, just a matter of locating the right ingredients, but it's not necessarily an extra cost. So that's simple to do. It's not so expensive. And so for a big corporation, a big manufacturer, to pay, you know, a few thousand dollars for a kosher certification fee and, you know, so a few other minor expenses, right? If Coca-Cola would pay $10 million for their kashrus, probably nobody would feel it in a cent on their bottle of Coke. Okay, so that's not such a big deal as long as they ascertain that all the ingredients are kosher. But when it comes to Pesach, there's a lot more stringencies, both in terms of the ingredients and in terms of the production lines. And when we kosherize a production line, it means shutting down the line for a minimum of 24 hours plus, because you need to clean the line and it needs to be not used for 24 hours before kosherizing, before kashering. So as that being the case, it means, you know, we want to have a story with a Israeli importer who belonged to the same corporation as the manufacturer of cereal, of a cereal company abroad, and they wanted to import cereal from them, and there was an issue importing at certain times of years of chadash. Without getting into the particulars of chadash, but the new grains until after the second day of Pesach aren't to be consumed. It's a matter of a dispute whether that pertains as well in the diaspora or not, or whether it's like Trumas and Maaser, so it's a mitzvah dafkan Israel. And there are those who are stringent about it in the diaspora as well. The OU actually has a webpage that gives a lot of information about the dates for anybody who wants to be stringent, from what date they should start being particular about different products. Many of the rabbis who work for the OU, myself included, are stringent upon that in the diaspora as well. Nonetheless, it would be close to impossible to certify products for only half a year. So therefore, we'll certify them year-round, and the consumer can make the decision whether they want to purchase those or not. But back to the matter in hand, in Israel, since one definitely needs to keep it, and until recently, most of the products in the market were Israeli manufactured. It was taken, you know, that everything that's in Israel is going to be Yashan, and therefore whatever is imported should also be Yashan, should be from the older produce. So when we discussed with them kosherizing their line, they said for the, you know, and this is one of the largest Israeli distributors. They said it's not worth it to us. Shut down line. We produce more in a day than Israel buys in half a year. So it's not worth it to us to shut down the line for a day in order to kosherize. So now, you know, I'll tell you a little story. We don't certify Pepsi, but I know the rabbi who certifies Pepsi, and he told me that one of his mashkichim, who went to kosher the plant for Pesach, so he was, you know, there, and he was working with all sorts of different apparatus, and the plant manager came down from the corporate level into the production areas and started asking him all sorts of questions about the kosherizing process, etc. And then he told him, he says, you know, when you finish this work, it looks like it's a pretty arduous job. How about you come and we'll drink a cheers to that? So he said, okay, whatever. He finished late at night. He figured the guy probably went home, but he said he's going to try his luck. He went up to the corporate level. Sure enough, he was still there waiting there, and he pulls out a bottle of scotch, and they start drinking, and he tells him, he says, Rabbi, how many months long is Passover? So he says, months? It's a week. The guy almost choked, you know, on the spot. He's like, what? A week? And you guys can't live without Pepsi for a week? Okay, so it's, you know, for a week of the kosher market, it's not all that worthwhile around the world to kosherize. Therefore, ingredients that could be made kosher still have challenges in getting them to be kosher, because very often the manufacturers of those ingredients, I'm not talking about the final products, the ingredients themselves, the manufacturer is not interested in. So now we already have difficulty with Pesach ingredients on an industrial level. And it's, yeah, if you're baking cake at home and you're taking a little bit of potato starch or matzah meal, depending if you bruck or don't bruck, and you take a little bit of cocoa powder and a little bit of sugar or whatever sugar substitute, honey or whatever other sugar substitute you're using on Pesach, right? And you mix them all together with a, you know, an egg or two and some other stuff. You bat up the eggs really well, separate them, because Pesach, you need the stuff to rise without being able to rise. And you put it in the oven for a little bit and you have some sort of cake that tastes, either tastes amazing or it doesn't, but that's beyond the fact. So that's not so complicated because they're very simple, basic ingredients. But when you make things industrially months ahead and you want things to last and you want lots of varieties because you have to compete with the rest of the market, it becomes much more complicated to have all those finite, you know, those tutti frutti flavors and all sorts of different, you know, fancy pre-line and whatever types of flavorings for all sorts of different cakes and ice creams and sorbets and snacks and candies and everything else. So it becomes much more complicated. And forget about when you get to the colorings, which, you know, probably some of the people in the room here would rather that their people don't have those colorings anyway. So what might end up happening is they use the things that are more poisonous for Pesach, but that's a different story. And forget about the elf, forget about all the other things, because whatever we can use is fair game. Although I'll tell you something, a lot of the products that use MSG year-round, when it comes to Pesach, don't use MSG. Okay, they use less. There's a lot of products, especially like deli products and hot dogs. If you want Frank's, whatever you want to call them, you want those types of products, usually the Pesach version is considerably less unhealthy than the year-round version. We stock up on those products. I always buy the Pesach hot dogs in mass, especially after Pesach when they go on sale, because they say Kosher Pesach on it. So we buy them, stick them in the freezer, and they taste better, actually. And I think, and they're certainly, you know, I don't know if I'm going to vouch for their health, but they're definitely less unhealthy. Anyway, you know, they're not as bad. It's a, you know, working in the field, it's not as bad as people make it out to be. It's not as horrendous as people make the, you know, the deli industry sound about all the garbage that goes in there. There might be some garbage, and some deli has more than others, but it's not, you know, there's a lot of real meat in there also. It might be meat that you needed to grind up finely in order to be able to eat, but it's real meat. And sometimes, you know, it's depending on the exact fat content, it has less fat content or more content, but that's things that they can blend in, they can control. So it's complicated to be able to manufacture, and then the manufacturer also has to be willing to kosherize the line. So much of the Pesach products in the market, even in America, are actually manufactured here. It doesn't mean that what's manufactured here without an OU is the same thing as what you buy in America with OU, even if it looks like a similar product, even if it has the same brand name on it. And that's for the very simple reason, as we mentioned before, that ingredients are hard to come by. And the better ingredients, there'd be supply and demand, because there's more hashkachos that are willing to use them. So they're going to be more costly, and they might be more sparse. So it's harder to get to obtain those, and they won't use it for anybody who will allow something else. Additionally, you know, year-round, there's certain knowledge which is more commonplace to have. And there's a lot of the issues that we have in the world of kashrus are issues that pertain only to Pesach kashrus. And that's because in regular kashrus, right, usually you're not going to use, unless it's a product that is a meat and dairy product, it's not going to be basar b'chalav. It won't be meat and dairy mixed together. You don't need to mix meat and dairy together in order to create most products. Okay, that's number one. Number two is there's very few things, especially in our day and age, as the world progresses and they're concerned about, you know, the carbon print and all that type of stuff. So there's much less products that stem from animal-based goods. So you still have, you know, there's still a gelatin that's ostensibly from, and I don't want to say ostensibly Treif, because that might be a whole different cheer in its own right, but you still have gelatin that might come from, you know, from pig, and or not kosher animals, and you might have, and you still have glycerin, probably the most common ostensibly Treif product on market, because, you know, it's kind of like bleach. You know, I remember my mother has her products that she buys only, you know, only brand name, and she has the products that she probably buys pretty much only generic name, unless there's some huge sale on the brand name. So one of those that she buys generic name is bleach. She won't buy Clorox, right? It's three times the price. So she'll buy whatever the generic name is, because bleach is bleach is bleach. So glycerin is glycerin is glycerin is also true, no matter what its source is, meaning there's no difference in the taste between glycerin, which is a great, if you don't need something to be very sweet, it's sweet and it doesn't have any calories to it, so it's a great sugar substitute, and it's used a lot in food manufacturing and baking in candies, etc. There won't be any difference what its source was from, but it's basically something which is separated out during the oil making process of almost any oil. So it can be plant-based or it can be animal-based. In Europe, it's a much more significant problem of being animal-based, so too in the, you know, in the Far East. But in much of the world, it's not an issue. Whereas when it comes to Pesach, many, many, many products come from chametz-based origins. Meaning, you know, that the wheat was used as a catalyst at some point in time, whether it's an alcohol-based thing, or whether it's some sort of sugar thing, and after making the flour and whatever it is, they use some various malt products that are left in the wheat because that's kind of refuse. It's the garbage. So it's sold for cheap. The main point of it was for the flour. They got the flour out of it. Now they can utilize whatever's left of the product. And certainly for Ashkenazi Jews who are makbid on kitniot, so kitniot, you have, once you expand it to corn and rice and all sorts of other products like that, again, there's an unbelievable amount of products that are manufactured as byproducts in some form or another from these sources. So most of them have ample substitutes. They're just often more expensive. I'm going to give an example that's in almost every food product you buy out there. Citric acid, okay? So citric acid, yes, it can come from a lemon in theory. In a lemon, you have citric acid. In orange, you have citric acid. In tomatoes, you have citric acid, okay? But it would be very costly to try to somehow, and I've never heard of anybody isolating citric acid from lemon juice. It would be extremely costly. So there are, you know, three basic or four different basic different methods that might be used to obtain the citric acid. Just to simplify for you the process of making citric acid, basically you have bacteria that feed off of a sugar, and what they excrete after feeding off of the sugar will be citric acid. Okay, so that's oversimplified. It takes a week for this to occur, and you have all sorts of reactors and paraphernalia that it goes through. It's usually a large site in order to manufacture citric acid, but that's the basic idea. So you can make that with starting with like a wheat malt, which is usually the cheapest option. You can do it from something like a corn mash, which will be like a corn malt, and that would be the second cheapest option. Or you can go to something like a white sugar, beet sugar, or cane sugar, or something like that, and it will be considerably more expensive. Okay, so in order to make it, so there are places that manufacture it from white sugar for whatever reason. There's actually an Israeli company that does this because of Pesach. But nonetheless, it's much more cumbersome, much more expensive. So that's just an example of a very common ingredient. Now, a lot of these ingredients are assumed year-round, they're chemicals, and you know, even if Ashkachos want to receive it with Ashkach, which very often the lesser good Ashkachos, so to speak, will more so rely on a paper trail, that they're going to want to see certification for every ingredient that comes in, because they don't know what ingredient really needs kosher certification or not, because they're not such experts in the world of food manufacturing. So during the year, they'll rely on all sorts of things, and they'll rely on basically, you know, any ashkacha and anything that sounds, you know, chemical, biochemical, etc. But when it comes to Pesach time, that might be a very precarious thing to do. Because, like I said, not all ashkachos are created equal. And if the one who's originally certifying it assumes, okay, it looks like just some sort of chemical process, so I'm not even going to get too involved in what it is, he might be certifying something which might be outright chametz. It just goes through, you know, a whole bunch of machinery and comes out, goes in one end chametz and comes out the other end chametz. Nothing happened to change it. No magic. So if that's the case, the ingredients might be much more problematic, and ashkacha that has less no than another ashkacha will very likely accept ingredients that are substandard into their Pesach products. And this is something which occurs all the time, probably between Sukkot and Pesach. We have at least four or five stories that come up with companies that we certify here in Israel and the other hashkachos that are certifying them for the Israeli market, that they've accepted ingredients that we're not accepting, and it causes problems because they want to know why aren't we going to accept it and whatever it is. And usually we'll call up the other hashkacha very often, and they don't want to hear it because they know the second that they do hear it, if they are mekabel, if they accept what we tell them, they're going to be in the same place as us, which will basically put them in the same place as, you know, one or two very, very strict Israeli hashkachos, and nobody's going to need them anymore because they don't have any magic tricks in their Mary Poppins bag. So that's really the story with Pesach products. Now, I know it sounded a little bit bleak, and I don't mean to be bleak at all. There are a lot of products, and every year there are more and more products that are kosher certified by good hashkachos, number one. Number two is some of those products you probably don't want to eat. Number three, I might have just saved you a lot of money. Your husbands might be happy. But the truth is there are a lot of products that are fine. And the more, you know, we always talk about that the consumer market is what generates the need. In Israel, the market is very different than the market in America. Market in America, it's true, everybody's used to having everything, etc. But they can't demand directly from the manufacturers. There's a much longer chain till it reaches back to the manufacturers what they need to do to be kosher enough for their consumers to be able to sell in Pesach. Whereas in Israel, that chain is much shorter. You're here. They see the manufacturers, it's their own labels. Are they being bought? Are they not being bought? So the kosher consumer is really the one who's most in control of the level that the kashrus will be of the products that they're purchasing. Because if they don't buy things, so then they're going to go, they're going to raise the standard to a standard that people will buy. But really what I meant to bring out is like this, is that one should be prudent not to just buy anything that says, you know, kashrus Pesach, and that they should really look for the, you know, the better ashkachos. That should be ultimately what they're looking for. You know, ashkachos that they recognize, that they know are good. If they don't know, they should ask a competent rabbi, you know, their local Orthodox rabbi, I think that's the jargon, right? So you should ask somebody that you trust and is in the know to see, you know, if it is ashkacha that you can rely on. And now we'll touch upon just, you know, one more element, which is the confusion around the labeling in Israel. And it's not just you. I work in kashrus and I'm also confused sometimes. So I want to explain a few things. You know, in America, there's a lot of regulation on the labels. And there's no understanding that it's a Pesach label, so that the ingredients that it says in the back doesn't have to match the fact that there's a P in the front, right? And there's no understanding that. So if it says Kashrus Pesach, and in the back it says, you know, and we're not talking about a Gebrauch product, but it says wheat flour or something like that in the back ingredients, so then you have a problem. Whereas in Israel, they say, okay, just for Pesach, I'll put a Kashrus Pesach, I'll stamp it on the front, and I'm not going to bother changing the ingredients panel. Okay, it's obvious I didn't use wheat flour in my kashrut Pesach product, and it will continue to bear the wheat in the the wheat flour and the ingredient, and have all sorts of warnings for gluten allergies, etc. And on the front, it will say kashrut Pesach with a very reputable hashgacha. Nobody seems to have too big of an issue with that here. So that will put to bed that, you know, usually if there is a good kashrut Pesach hashgacha on the front or wherever it is, don't pay too much attention to what it says in the ingredient panel. You know, it's there's actually a story here in Israel with Mechiras Chametz, that one of the big bakeries about 20 years ago sold their chametz on Pesach, and the guy didn't want to sell back to them after Pesach. So it went to court. This was, you know, extreme loss, because you also sell the chametz in the kelim, so you can't really use the kelim without his permission. It's got complicated. And in court, they ruled that the mechira is not a real mechira. It's only a, it's only like a what do you call it? Like a religious, you know, symbolic type of thing, and that it's not a real mechira. And of course, after Pesach, it goes back to its original owner. Okay, which that lends to a different question then. Well, was the chametz shavuot of a Pesach? So that could have been a different topic for a shir, you know, mechiras chametz. Why some people do or don't sell their chametz, but we're not going to get into that right now. The idea is that in Israel there's a general allowance for, you know, there's a chok ezer also in Yerushalayim. You're allowed to build your sukkah on the sidewalk. You have set you for 8 days or 9 days, something like that is the law. Now, they also have a certain amount of time. If they want to give you like a ticket for leaving on the sidewalk, you have a week to dismantle it. So, you know, there's a chok ezer that allows that wiggle room that you have about 2-3 weeks that you can have your sukkah up on public domain here in Israel. So there's a certain amount of wiggle room. They understand they're not going to make every manufacturer change, you know, reprint labels just for that 1 week that they can't live without Pepsi for. So that they'll have the, you know, that the label might say something which is outright chametz on the back of it, and on the front of it say kashrut Pesach. But then there are products where the hashgacha itself writes underneath it, you have, you know, some sort of badatz or hashgacha, and it says limot hashana bilvad, or lo kolel Pesach, right? Year-round use, year-round certification only, doesn't include Pesach. And then you have on the top, ink-jetted, next to the production date, it says kashlap, or kasher lePesach. Or if it's a dairy product, it might say kasher lePesach, erev Pesach, right? Or in the abbreviated version. And the question is, who's certifying that for Pesach? The bedat symbol on it said limot hashana bilvad. The rabbanut doesn't say anything either way, and this is in a different place in some inkjet on the product. Now, in theory, the reason why the bedats actually said that they want that local Pesach on is because they didn't want that if the Rabbanut says Kashal Pesach, it should be misconstrued that they certified for Pesach, because maybe it's something that the Rabbanut felt could be certified for Pesach, and they felt it shouldn't be certified for Pesach, or they weren't comfortable enough with certifying it for Pesach. But nowadays, in general, they will demand that if it's going to be inkjetted on a product, that, again, the more reputable bedatzim for sure, out of kasher lePesach, and they don't view it as such, they will require it to say Rabbanut Bilvad next to that inkjet. And if it doesn't say Rabbanut Bilvad, then it can be assumed that the bedatz, even though it says Lo Kolel Pesach underneath it, that means Lo Kolel Pesach, if it's not inkjetted somewhere on this product, kasher lePesach. So that's one clue to the maze of Pesach kashrus here. Ochlei kitniot is, you know, pretty straightforward. If you eat kitniot, so then, and you rely on the hashgacha that's certifying it, so it's lochlei kitniot. But now there's another thing, which is lochlei litzitin. Okay, some products have come up with these types of terms, or liftit, lochlei liftit. They've come up with terms to describe certain items that might be a matter of discrepancy as to whether, between various halachic authorities, as to whether they're kitniot or not. So I'm just going to give a brief explanation of liftit and litzitin, which are kind of similar one to another. And that's basically as follows. Kitniot, there were two main concerns with products that being kitniot. One is that they could be confused with grains because they look like grains and they're used similar to the grains, or whatever, halachic grains, I should say, things that could become chametz, right? Rice looks like a grain, and you can make rice flour out of it, and you can bake from rice flour, so it's similar to a grain. Various other products would fall into a similar category that you can, looks like a grain, you can grind it and make it turn into a grain. And then you have products that are, that the other reason were products that were often stored together with grains and therefore often would have grains mixed into them. So you might have a product, nobody grinds mustard seed and makes mustard bread, but mustard was traditionally stored together with wheat, especially in certain countries. So therefore there's a gzeira on mustard as well. Certain products have both of those conditions. Now there were products that weren't around when the Ashkenazi enactment against kitnios came into play. And at that point in time, the rabbis only made the enactment on things that were eaten. So there's a matter of discrepancy whether New World food would fall into the same category. So while peanuts are a legume, and most legumes were included in the gzeira, so there were those that said, well, peanuts, we only discovered those in America, right? When we came from the Haim to America, that was when we discovered peanuts. And therefore, peanuts weren't really around during the gzeira. Okay, it's mentioned in Chumash, you have to know what that means. When Yaakov told his sons to bring to Yosef botnim, if that's what we call botnim or not, but that's a different subject. Anyway, but it wasn't something that was commonplace to eat, and therefore that wasn't something that's mentioned in the list of the original kitnius gzera. There are those that would say similar thing about corn. Corn is also mostly a North American discovery, so to speak, a New World food, and it wasn't something that was commonplace when they made the gzera in Europe. There are those that argue that maybe it already made its way to Europe. That's a historical point of contention. Anyway, there is a product that's very, very often used nowadays, and that's called canola oil. Now, canola oil comes from something called rapeseed. Okay, the rapeseed belongs to the mustard family, and if you see it on the side of the road, you think it's mustard, like a wild mustard. However, it has a very, very, very bitter taste. That's number one. And number two is the oil that we have is doubly refined. So those that wanted to say that this isn't considered mustard because nobody ever ate it. And until they found a way, and originally canola oil was discovered by trying to make crude oil out of natural resources, out of plant resources. So that was the original source. Afterwards, it was refined, and that's the case with many things. When they sell very cheap olive oil, and especially in Israel, you find it sometimes in the supermarket, which is refined, and it says refined olive oil, which is basically the same thing as the Shemen Lamar, with the cheap olive oil that you buy for lighting candles, like or Hanukkah licht or something like that. And it's but that has like this very darkish tinge to it, much darker than the normal olivey green color. And that's unrefined. That's after, they really press everything out of it and it's unrefined and it's more of a crude oil. So it's probably not poisonous because it's from an olive and you can eat the whole olive, so it's not poisonous. But it's not very tasty. But if you refine it and you pull out all the garbage from inside of it, you'll end up with an oil which will be similar tasting to virgin olive oil. And that will just be a much cheaper option to have virgin olive oil. So too the rapeseed oil that we buy, the canola oil, what's done to it is it goes through a refining process to take out all the bitterness from it, and it turns basically from something that the only thing you can think to use it for would be crude oil into being food oil, which is healthier than some of the other options on the market. That's why it's gained popularity in terms of saturated fat and similar types of oil-related issues. And the question is that kitnios or not? So there are people who want to say that it's not kitnios. It's become generally accepted amongst the major kashrus agencies that it is kitnios. And Rabbi Belsky used to say, for the simple fact, if it looks like kitnios and it grows like kitnios, and it's the same exact, he says, we're not going to start differentiating, then it is kitnios. We're not going to start differentiating between, the exact taste of this variation or that variation. He said he thought that that was, too much splitting hairs. So what they'll do is they'll write lochle liftit, and the truth is, I don't think it's a smart idea even for them, because most of the people have not a clue what lochle liftit is. And so most people say, well, liftit, I don't know, I never ate liftit on Pesach before, and they'll leave it behind, even if maybe somebody would have convinced them of the argument that it's fine. Anyway, so that's the story with lochle liftit, when it says that on a product, or lochle litzitin. That's generally what it means, that it contains one of those rapeseed byproducts, and it's definitely not OU standards, and I think that's the end of what I have to say about a guide to products for today. If there's time, I'm happy to take questions. Okay, so there could be many reasons for that, or a few reasons at least for that. Number one is if it's a simple, you know, very simple regular spice, it's the difference probably is when in the process when in the season of Pesach spices was it processed, so that when ours was done. We did it right after the cleaning and achshara of whatever needed to be cleaned or kashered respectively. And therefore, it was kitnios free when it was done. Later on, they had done some kitnios runs for various Israeli Sephardic certifications. And then they wanted to go back and do some, you know, let's just say paprika, paprika, however you want to pronounce it, for argument's sake. So it could just, you know, if there's no oil added to that paprika, then it's very likely that all that happened was that it was just when in the process it was done, when in the season it was done. It could be that some of them have oils added to it, if you look carefully. Some of them might say it in the actual name, and others might just say it in the ingredients, you know, especially if it's a spice blend. Okay, others, there might be certain items that, again, which will usually be, again, back to what I said, that when you're not in the know, you're not in the know. So there are a lot of people, if it's a spice they didn't hear of before, they'll say, they'll assume, oh, maybe that's kitniot, and they'll label it as kitniot. Whereas the OU maybe didn't label it as kitniot. So sometimes that might be the reason. Again, once they viewed it as kitniot, they might have packaged it once the line was already kitniot. How particularly you have to be about that, that's a different question which you can ask your Rav. But that's, you know, so there might be certain things. Coriander. So some of the Israeli Ashkachos will view coriander as always being kitnios, even though really only the coriander seeds are kitnios and the coriander itself is not kitnios. Just as an example.
Can I ask about quinoa in the States?
People use it here also, and there are people who don't use it in the States also. Quinoa. The question was about quinoa, or quinoa, quinoa, however you want to pronounce it. So the story with quinoa is as follows. For many years, the OU took the vantage point that it's kitnios. Because it's a grain, it's often stored together. It can be used as a grain in all forms of it. And it is often stored in similar places to other grains. Because of its health value and because of people having increasingly stricter diets for all sorts of, whether it's just for, because people become more aware of bad health and good health in terms of dieting practices, or whether it's because there's more allergies around, et cetera, than once upon a time, or whether it's that we're more aware of those allergies that are around, people have much more restricted diets than they once had. So as time progressed and there were many more people who were gluten-free, you know, celiac, et cetera, and various other allergies, there was more and more pressure to try to see if there's any way to be moderate. Back to what we said about New World food. So if Moshe Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, was from the trailblazers of maintaining that anything that wasn't part of the original gzeira wouldn't be part of the gzeira on nowadays, and Ramosha ate peanuts in his house on Pesach. If You know, very often, if somebody would come into Moshe's house on Pesach, he would offer them a bowl of peanuts, and they were in the shell. I'm not so to remember having seen it in Moshe's house, but I saw it by his children. So combined between that and the fact that you looked into it from certain countries where they looked into it, they found that it's no longer grown next to wheat, often not stored either with wheat and similar types of things, and therefore they decided that based on Rav Moshe's tshuva and what they felt was the metzios, and Rabbi Shechter Shlita felt very strongly that it shouldn't be viewed as kitnios, and therefore the OU went ahead and certified it. However, we are particular; it should say quinoa on the label for those who don't eat quinoa. I personally don't eat quinoa. Rabbi Belsky Zichron Levracho was also one of the OU poskim. As to Rabbi Asher Weiss Shlita, and the truth is, even Rabbi Moshe's children maintained similar to Rabbi Belsky, which was as follows. Rabbi Belsky said that Rabbi Moshe meant an item that doesn't have all the tanaim, all the conditions of kitnios, but something which meets all the conditions of kitnios, even if it wasn't around then, that's included. Things like peanuts, nobody makes peanut bread out of just grinding up the peanuts, and it doesn't, it's not necessarily stored with wheat products or anything like that, just because peas were, right, and it grows similar to peas. That's not enough of a reason to assume it kitnios. Right, Belsky felt that all the more so since the OU does view peanuts as kitnios, we certainly should not go out on a limb and view quinoa as kitnios. Nonetheless, because of the health advantages, the decision was that the OU would certify it, but it needs to say clearly if it would be some sort of mix that you buy and it has quinoa in the mix, then it would have to say on it very clearly that it has quinoa in it. So in Eretz Yisrael, there's generally a stricter view on kitnios than in America. Most of the large ashkachos assume it to be kitnios. Additionally, most of the rabbanuyot, I think the rabbanut Rashid views it as kitnios because, again, when you have a large Sephardi population and many, many of the people anywhere are eating kitnios, you feel less of a need to say that something shouldn't be viewed as kitnios. If somebody wants to buy it, even though others might view it as kitnios because they feel it's not, so you're not stopping them from buying it. So in Israel, in America, once the OU certifies it, so then a lot of people will just assume it's totally fine and buy it and use it. Whereas in Israel, there's a little bit more, there's a little bit more reluctancy because it's still assumed to be kitnios by most.